welcome to the Business of Property podcast. I'm Simon. I've been investing in property for over 20 years, and if you're an active landlord or planning your next property investment, this podcast provides interesting and useful conversations to help your property journey. If you're willing and able to leave a rating or review in your podcast player of choice, I would very much appreciate it. Now, today I am joined by Philip Malarides. Hopefully I got that name correctly. I have been practicing, and I'm sure he'll correct me in a moment if I didn't. And Philip is currently supporting people in property along their own property journeys. But he is also very, very experienced with his own very eventful property journey that I think we're going to explore a bit today, but also dig into some of the projects he's been involved in the past. So I think some of them sound really quite interesting, and I'm looking forward to asking questions and digging into some details here. So to get us started, you have been a landlord since 1996, and how did you get started? What was that first property, and why did you buy it in the first place?
Well, first of all, Simon, thanks very much for inviting me onto this podcast today. It's really an honour to be with you. First property I actually bought as my own residential property. I started off very young. I was 19 at the time, and I was lucky enough to be gifted the deposit from my dad. Although you must remember that when I bought my first property, it was a long, long time ago, and property prices were not as bad as they are now. So I think I started off with a 5% deposit, which was, actually it was probably a little bit less, because I had $5,000 and the property cost me £90,000. And it was a little two-bed end of terrace house with a little garden and those kind of things. So that was my first foray into property. Nothing to do with property investing or anything like that. It was literally my own home.
So how did that become property investing for you?
It was very much accidental, to be honest. During that time in the early 90s, I got married, and then got to about 95. And the other half was saying, well, you know, she wanted to move out more into the country. So we started looking for property, and we found one. We thought, oh, that's good. But the problem was that at that time, interest rates were at 16%, or they'd just been through 16%. Everyone was in arrears, even myself. And actually, the property values had dipped as well. So I ended up in negative equity. So the chances of selling my house were next to none, really, if I wanted to pay off the mortgage and come out with some money. So what we did was bought the house that we liked, that we wanted, and kept the first one. And hey presto, I became a landlord overnight. So we didn't get, you know, a buy-to-let mortgage or anything like that. We purely went to the mortgage company and said, okay, we're moving, we want to rent out, will you give us permission? And they said yes. So we bought and moved the new property and started renting out the old one with a local agent who managed it for us.
Did you do much research into sort of the concept of being a landlord before you took that move?
No. Not really.
Well, that's fair enough.
The only reason for renting it out and becoming a landlord was to move. It was very different back then to what it is now, because, you know, property investing is huge industry now. And back then it was nothing like this.
There were still millions of landlords out there, weren't there? So private landlords. So it was a big industry somewhere.
The strange thing is that when I look back, I'm actually surprised at how many people I was surrounded with who were in property. My dad had various clients because he was an accountant, and you know, he had clients and friends who would convert houses into flats and those kind of things. So subconsciously, I was always around it. So the seed had been sown, even though I just didn't realize it at the time.
I think it's it's much easier, I think, to get into property accidentally. And you're not quite sure you're going to go there or not. But then you just do and you go with it and it just flows and happens. So I think around that time and sort of a bit after that, I think you said, you were also working in property, as in your day job, and a different kind of property. It wasn't investing in typical buy-to-let property. But I think you were working on what is probably now called rent-to-rent, but back then it wasn't. So what was your day job looking like in property?
Absolutely. Well, I was working, there was a group of us working up in London, and we were working with the London councils, and we were providing emergency accommodation. The guys that I was working with, they did own some property. They owned a couple of hotels, small hotels, those kind of things. But the majority of the properties that we had were owned by different people. And we would rent those properties, offer those people, give them what's now called guaranteed rent. And then we would work with the local councils, and they would give us people, and we would place them in the properties and look after the properties, look after the maintenance and those kind of things, and then just invoice the local councils, the London councils, monthly. Mm-hmm. which was really good. So that was, in effect, that was the beginning of the rent to rent model back then.
Yeah. At that point, were you taking on sort of commercial tenancies or commercial contracts with the landlords you were renting from, or was it something different?
No, they were very simple. You know, it's in a way they were management agreements, so that we would manage it. So ASTs didn't come into it at all for the whole process. So they were management agreements between the company and the landlords themselves. And then obviously we had different agreements with the local councils. And it wasn't just one council. There was probably six or seven that we worked with in central London. Mm-hmm. So I can't even remember how many properties we were looking after, to be honest, but it was quite a few.
Can you remember how the dynamic sort of worked? As in, did the councils, were they your customers? And they said, we need to find homes for these 100 people or something, and you went off and sourced the homes? Or did you go out and look for the homes and then go to the councils and say, we've got these 100 rooms spare, have you got anyone who'd like them?
It was just a continual process to, you know, we had the girls in the office, and they would work with the councils, so they'd be on the phone every day, and, you know, so we would be looking for properties on a continual basis, because there was always people looking for homes in emergency accommodation with the council. So it was just a continual process. It wasn't, you know, they'd come to us and say, we've got 100 people we need to house. It was just continual. Although later on in the process, we did do a commercial to resi development. Again, this was long before it became very common.
Trendy, I think, is the word.
Trendy, I think that's the word I was looking for. You know, you had to go through all the planning and those kind of things. But again, it was purely to house emergency accommodation for one of the councils. So it was a specific project for a specific council.
Rent to rent before it was rent to rent. It's very, very interesting.
I know. And the other interesting thing as well is that, you know, back then it was the time when we were involved in creating the leases that are now seen as the guaranteed rent leases that people try and get you in. So it was 2-year, 3-year, 5-year leases. So we were in the forefront of creating those with the local councils, and that's kind of when they came about.
So it's all your fault, right?
Well, I not my fault, but, you know, because we actually poached someone from one of the local councils to come and work with us.
Cool. Well, I think moving on from your creation of rent to rent, in the background, you were building your own property portfolio. And I think we're going to sort of gloss over that a little bit. But zooming forwards to around 2011 where it all went a bit wrong. So I don't think I want to or quite know how to intro this. So maybe I'll hand over to you and let you walk us through this stage.
Yeah, kind of went wrong in a dramatic way, really. So I'd built up my portfolio then, I think of 4 or 5 properties, because I'd moved a couple of times after that. But my journey, I've always been an entrepreneur. And so I always had my own businesses, as well as at the same time working in other businesses as well. There's always been senior management. And throughout that time, I ran a logistics company, and that was in 2005. And come 2011, what happened was in that time, because I was only there for 2 years, so 2004 to 2006. And in 2011, I actually got tagged onto a trial, which was a conspiracy to defraud VAT. And I was tagged onto that trial because they said I was complicit in the fraud with the fraudsters who were up in Birmingham. So I'm down in Heathrow and they're up in Birmingham. Actually, I knew them, kind of met one of them once or twice, but I wasn't actually working with them to commit the fraud. I was actually just doing what I was being paid for, which was transporting mobile phones. But, you know, I got tagged onto the trial. Lots of shenanigans went on. Things didn't really go well. I eventually got convicted of the fraud. Got sent to prison. I did 3.5 years, or 3 years, 3 months, behind the door. And out of all that, I actually lost everything. So through something called confiscation, I had lost all my properties. I lost all my savings. I lost my jobs. Absolutely everything. So by the time I came out, it was as if I was a 16-year-old child again. I was kind of just leaving school, living at home, with no prospects, because I couldn't get a job, I couldn't get anywhere to live, and all those kind of things. So that's how I went from being a millionaire with my property portfolio to actually being a pauper with absolutely nothing.
Wow. Oh, I'm very, very sorry to hear you've been through all that. And I mean, this is a property podcast, so I'm not going to dig into that particular experience, really, but it does just create so many questions in another situation I'd be very curious to talk more about. And yeah, it sounds like a horrific experience, really. But seeing as we are a property podcast and we try to look on the positive side mostly, you did rebuild. So how did you just start that rebuilding before we get on to sort of where you've ended up?
So it all started whilst I was behind the door, whilst I was in prison. So it was the change of mindset, really, that triggered it. So I was, you know, the first few months I was full of blame. I wanted to get revenge, and it's all this why me and those kind of things. Whereas actually what happened was I came into today and said, right, I took responsibility for myself and said, okay, what's the reality? What can be done? So I did lots of training. I did lots of mindset work. And so I started looking forward rather than looking backwards. That got me here. Now, where do I go? So what I needed to do was just work with people strategically in order to move forward, because there's always a way to do something. And if you've got the determination, the perseverance and the discipline to move forward, which is very important in property, then you can actually do whatever you want to do.
Mm. So with your new mindset and your new approach, once you were that 16-year-old again, starting from scratch, what were your first steps to actually sort of pick yourself up and get going again, and especially to get back into property again, which I know you have done.
The first few years were pretty pretty catastrophic, really. I didn't do too much because I was too busy trying to hide away from what had happened, the feelings of shame and embarrassment and those kind of things. But actually, as time went on, people love Google, don't they? So I used to do lots of networking and meeting lots of people. And people would then start to Google me and find out a bit more about myself. And they come up with the questions, is that you? And so I was kind of forced to have to talk about it. And actually, the response that I got was more of support rather than negative judgment, which it kind of surprised me. And at that point, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to start talking about it. And so that started my speaker journey. But it also taught me that actually, I just need to be myself and move forward. And the problem that I had was I was always chasing the money. I was always trying to get back what I had lost. Because, you know, when I had all the properties, I was quite risk adverse, really. I didn't want to build this huge portfolio of properties just by going out and getting loans and leveraging the properties and remortgaging and all this kind of stuff. Because weirdly enough, I was scared of the risk. I was scared of losing all the properties. But then when I did lose them all, I didn't have the feelings that I thought I would have. So now with my newfound confidence, if you like, my family are into property anyway. And so I started working with my sister or my two sisters to actually create a new property portfolio, actually as a legacy for the children, really, for my nieces, my nephews, and my own son. So it wasn't for me. I wasn't working for me now. I was working for them.
It's good sort of change in motivation and to help push you forwards from that thought, I would think. So I know that you've done lots of different things and lots of different projects in sort of rebuilding your property world. But there's one in particular I thought we might pick up on today, mostly because it's a style of property investment that I've been curious about for many, many years, actually. And this is purchasing a block of flats, a whole block, unbroken block. And I understand you have purchased or helped to purchase such a property, and you did this at auction. So I wonder if you can sort of talk us through that whole process. How did you find this property? Were you specifically looking for a block of flats, or did you come across it in some other way?
It was more about finding properties that were in the right price range, trying to make the figures, the numbers stack up. And at that point, we're probably looking 8 years ago, 8-9 years ago. Property within the M25, forget it, because you know the yields don't stack up and you can't make money from them. Even though interest rates were very low, the numbers just didn't stack up. And that's very important when you're looking at a deal, because if the numbers aren't there, then it's just no point doing it. So I started looking at auctions and looking at the different auction houses and those kind of things. And I kind of made a friend actually from Auction House London, Jay Howard. Don't know whether you know him, but he's big in auctions and we kind of made friends and I got into auctions and I started thinking, okay, well, this is it. How can we purchase the properties through auctions to make it work? And with his advice, we were looking at, okay, how can you add value to a property? That's the key thing, because when you're looking at properties from auction, you're looking at buying them below the market value. And that's really the key for auctions. I mean, I went around and I looked at loads of properties. I used to do loads and loads of viewings, and you have to go and see the properties and see how you can add value, see what you can do to them. Yeah. And this block that came up, it was is a terraced house converted into four flats. So it's four floors. They're one bed flats, and they're all on single title. And they went into an auction, but they didn't sell. Well, I think they did sell, but then the sale didn't go through. So then they were put into the next auction, and I kind of saw them and I thought, okay, that's on the list. Let's see how we go. And when you buy auction, you've got to make sure that when you're looking at a property, you value it up and you put that cap on where you're going to bid, because it's so easy to just get carried away. Oh, yep, that'll be me. Oh, yep, that'll be me. And when you're in an auction, you've got to make sure that you know who you're bidding against, because a lot of properties, and half the time you meet these people when you're doing the viewings as well, so you get a feel for them when you're walking around. And some of them are looking for their forever home or their own home. That's going to be their home. So they're not thinking, oh, I need to get it for this price because I'm going to spend this and that's my profit. They're thinking, I like that house, I'm going to buy it. So when you're bidding, you think, okay, I'm bidding against someone here who wants it for their own home. I'm not even going to bother. I'm going to take myself out now, because it will just go up and up and up, and it'll get to the point where it's just not worth it. But luckily, this one, we you know, I was bidding on it, and we managed to get it, which was great. It needed some work, because there was the council had become involved, and they had their list that they wanted done with the previous owner. The previous guy wasn't very well respected, put it that way. I think you'd probably call him a rogue landlord, to be honest. So there was some work to be done before the council would sign it off. Mm-hmm. But that, I think it was like $290, $291 we paid for it, down in Ramsgate. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, so that was bought in a limited company. So it was my sister's limited company. She got some funding for the deposit from a private lender. So that was all done. And then we had to get bridging, first of all, to complete the purchase in, you're supposed to complete in 28 days.
Yep. Yeah, indeed. It's always a challenge with auction.
We didn't. Again, you see, it's all this learning curve and doing things in the wrong way in order to learn. So we had lots of back and, you know, to and fro between us and the owner. So in a way, it was his fault that we couldn't complete in 28 days, but we had to pay the penalty. It's because that's the contract, you know. But yeah, so we did that, and then we spent 3 months doing the work, and then it got signed off, and then my sister went and got the mortgage to get out of the bridge.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't finish in, or didn't complete in 28 days. Can you remember how long it did take?
It probably took. It was only about another probably a couple of weeks.
Weren't far off, really.
It wasn't too bad, but the fact is that actually you can extend the time. Mm-hmm. And if you're on good terms with the other solicitors, because they can force you to complete. Mm-hmm. But they were okay. They were saying, okay, well, it's kind of our side's fault, so we can't really say anything about it. But, actually we'll give you that extra time. So it was kind of lucky in that respect.
Yeah, that's good. So you purchased this for $290-ish, I think you said. Can you remember how much the refurbishment was? Just roughly.
So it's probably spent about $40 altogether on the refurbishment.
And then when you remortgaged, presumably you got it revalued up a bit. Did the company end up with money still in, or were you able to hit that holy grail and get money out? All your money out, should I say.
Even today, there's still money in the deal, which is fine. but today's valuation is about, I think last year, mid last year, was about 450. So it's had a nice uplift. And the other good thing about it is that we can still do a title split. So at the moment, the four flats are still under one title for the whole building. Mm-hmm. But you could, if you wanted to, title split, so each flat has its own title, and then you could individually sell them off, which would bring you in more money. That would, because I think a one-bed flat down in Ramsgate is about 150, 160. So, you know, you probably come out with 600 rather than 450. So it's a big difference.
Yeah, I'm just surprised.
By spending that little bit of money to split the title.
Yeah, I'm surprised that's such a big difference, actually. So that's good. So have you actually looked into the process of splitting the title?
Kind of roughly, not really any in any detail, because we're kind of not doing anything with it. You know, my sister recently moved out to Cyprus. So, you know, I'm kind of managing the property for her, and it's there really for her future and the children's future and retirement and those kind of things. So actually it's a hold model. So buy and hold rather than trying to make some money to move on to the next project.
Yeah, you're not in a rush.
No.
So you can take your time on it and move gradually. So I think that it would be really nice to buy a block of flats that you can then hold, because it gives you sort of the benefit of multiple tenancies, a bit like sort of HMOs. So you've got, if one tenancy is not there, so I should say if one unit is empty, then you've got the other three to support it and things like that. Yeah. So it gives you that flexibility. But unlike HMO, because they're individual flats, they are single lets. So you don't have to worry about the utilities. You don't have to worry about the sort of communal area maintenance and stuff like that. So this is sort of why I've been interested in blocks of flats for a while. Do you think they are actually a good investment? Have I missed something in my sort of very high level analysis here? Would you recommend blocks of flats to people?
Definitely recommend them. You do have a communal area still, so you kind of still have to look after that bit and everything, although it's very small and just access to the flats, so quite minimal. But yes, I mean, unlike a HMO, for example, you don't have the individual tenants and the upkeep and things that go wrong, so they don't move on so much. So it is nice that people make it their own home. You do still have various fire safety features, so you know all the doors still have to be fire doors. And looking at internally in the flats, you have to make sure that certain areas are segmented in the way that the councils want. And you still have to put in a fire alarm and these kind of things. So there's still things that you need to do. But then again, you know, they are individual places. They tend to be people who are going to stay longer. They make them their own home. The wear and tear on the property is a lot less than you would think, and the bonus is that you can title split, so there is an uplift in the future. The only downside, I guess, is, you know, with things like SDLT, stamp duty, you can't get multiple dwellings relief, which actually they've done away with anyway. So that hasn't changed or made it any more difficult. But the financing, the mortgages, mortgage companies, again, that's kind of reduced because it's seen as multiple dwellings. And there's a lot less lenders willing to lend on those type of properties, depending on whether you're going to hold it in your own name or in a limited company.
Have you found that the finance is also more expensive due to that, or is
Yes, because, I mean, because it's in a limited company, it's finance costs now are horrendously expensive. Yeah, it does make a difference, mm-hmm. and that's why it's so important to buy right.
Yes, indeed, or buy mediumly and just hold for a very long time, and time will fix it for you.
Yeah, depending on how much work it may need in the first instance, and how long you can wait out before you can remortgage and those kind of things. So there's still lots of variables to look at, but it's quite a good way to get an uplift in the rents, really.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a model I'm going to continue to explore, and hopefully next time I'm ready to purchase. Maybe I'll find a good block of flats to buy. We shall see.
Plenty come up in auction even still, and if you look in the right areas, there are some that come up, and they're cracking deals.
Yeah, I think I'm my own worst enemy in that, because I try to restrict my geographic area to relatively local to me, because I want to be able to self-manage, and that means I don't want to have to travel too far. And of course, where I'm based, you know where we are, we're around the Red Hill area, and it's a little pricey.
Exactly, within the M25, forget it. But Kent, you know, down towards, you know, where we are, Ramsgate, Folkestone, Dover, those kind of areas, you know, there are properties out there that come up quite regularly, and they're decent prices. I mean, obviously now they have increased over time, but you can still get good deals from there.
Oh, well, I shall keep my eyes peeled. So in that particular project, you were very much supporting your sister.
Yes.
And you provided a lot of support services sort of through that, and you still are, by helping manage that and things. Now, I know you also provide sort of support services in the property realm to a wider audience. I don't think it's quite the same flavour of support you offer for other people, though. So what is your sort of primary business in that area these days?
Yes, I mean, you know, I am a coach, mentor and trainer. So I've studied coaching, life coaching, those kind of goal setting, for example. And I'm also a mentor because I bring 35 years of business experience plus the 25 years of actual property ownership and management to the fore with project management as well. I'm a qualified project manager as well. So with all that experience, I help business owners to discover what it is they want to do and then help them with their journey, because it's about fulfillment and becoming happy. And a lot of people are sold the dream, and you know they people talk about passive income, property being passive income. Well, I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but there's no such thing as passive income. You can get semi-passive, but at some point you've got to do some work, especially to make it pay. If you're looking for cash flow and those kind of things, then it is a different kettle. You've got to understand the nuances and what happens. So I support property people. So they could be investors, they could be working in property, they could be agents. I work with sourcers, people who want to do rent to rent, a whole myriad of people who are doing serviced accommodation, all these people, because you have to look at your property as a business. So you need to think as a business, looking at numbers, looking at your values, looking at how to do everything. And that's what I bring to the table. So I work with someone to find out what it is they want, what it is they're looking for, what is that end goal, what is that vision, and then guide and support them on that journey so that they don't make the mistakes that a lot of people make. And not take them for a ride either. It's because with me, it's coaching comes from the heart, and it's not about the money. Obviously we all need money because we've got to pay the bills and those kind of things, but it's my my goals, my vision is completely different to where it was 15 years ago. And if you asked me 15 years ago, yeah, it was probably all about the money, to be fair. But now it's not about the money. It's about experiences and spending time with your loved ones and those kind of things. And that's how my life has changed. And so what I want to do is make sure that the people that I work with reach that fulfillment, reach that happiness, whatever that may be, because everyone's different and everyone has a different idea. But it's about finding your idea, not someone else's.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely perfect for sort of the philosophy that the Business of Property podcast often talks about. And I couldn't agree more with so many of the things that you've said there. And certainly creating a property business does take work. It doesn't come for free. You can't be completely passive and completely absent from a business. It needs someone to run it and to take control and leadership of it. And yeah, seeking support along that way, I think makes a lot of sense. So if listeners are hearing this and also agree, how can they get in touch with you?
Many different ways. Come and find me on social media. I'm you know, take a note of my name and just stick it in Facebook or LinkedIn or Instagram. No, not on Instagram. Well, you might be. Come and find me. I'm just thinking, I think on Instagram, I'm actually on Activate Your Success handle rather than my name. So if you put my name in there, I'm not quite sure what comes up.
For a moment, I was thinking you've just done so much social media, you'd forgotten which platforms you're
exactly,
on anymore.
Exactly. I'm just everywhere. It's easy to come and find me because I am prolific on social media. So just come and connect and have a conversation.
Well, we'll make it even easier than that. There will be links in the show notes to you and your businesses and your profiles, as many as we can collect from you. We'll be in the show notes.
Fabulous.
So people can just open those and click straight through. So they don't even need to search. We'll make it super easy. So thank you very, very much for joining us today, Philip, and sharing your incredible story with the ups and the downs and the rebuilding afterwards and your current sort of philosophy and approach to life and supporting people. I think that's
absolutely.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you know, thank you for inviting me on and being able to tell my story. And even though we kind of just touched on it really, because it goes so much deeper. But you know, it's people will know by listening to me here now that I'm an authentic person, and integrity is quite an important value that I hold. And if anyone wants to know more, you know, just come and ask.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you very much for being so open. And as you say, it's a shame that we haven't had the time to dig into more details really, because I think there are many, many more very fascinating and educational elements to your story.
Absolutely.
So for everyone listening, it just remains for me to say, please do leave us a rating or review in your podcast player of choice, and I will talk to you again next week.